Have you ever walked into a space and felt instantly lighter, as though the room itself was giving you permission to breathe? Perhaps it was a cathedral with soaring ceilings, or a friend's sunlit kitchen where conversation flowed effortlessly. Now think of the opposite, that fluorescent-lit waiting room or cramped apartment where you felt your spirit slowly deflating. These aren't random feelings. Our built environment doesn't just shelter our bodies, it shapes our emotional lives in ways we barely acknowledge. Buildings become silent witnesses to our existence, holding memories within their walls and influencing our moods through their proportions, materials, and light. A room with high ceilings and natural wood doesn't just look pleasant, it actively supports our better selves, while a badly designed space can confirm our worst suspicions about life's incompleteness. This isn't frivolous interior decoration. It's about understanding how profoundly our surroundings shape who we become. Throughout history, humanity has been caught in a strange contradiction. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus dismissed caring about bits of stone and pretty rock when your house burns down. Christian hermits like St. Alexandra sold their homes to live in tombs, while St. Bernard of Clairvaux traveled past Lake Geneva without noticing its beauty. Yet, despite centuries of such teachings, humans have persistently carved decorations, embroidered textiles, and dreamed of ideal homes. Our sensitivity to surroundings stems from a troubling feature of human psychology. We harbor many different selves within us, not all of which feel equally authentic. We need our environments to embody and remind us of the moods and ideas we respect, to hold us like psychological molds to helpful visions of ourselves. For over 1,000 years, Western civilization agreed on beautiful buildings. Classical architecture with temple fronts, decorated columns, and symmetrical facades. Then, in 1747, Horace Walpole built the world's first Gothic house, rejecting convention for medieval inspiration. Within decades, Gothic buildings appeared everywhere. By the early 19th century, architects designed in Indian, Chinese, Egyptian, Islamic, Tyrolean, or Jacobean styles, any historical period you desired. This explosion bordered on chaos, epitomized at Castle Ward in Northern Ireland, where Viscount Bangor and Lady Anne Bligh couldn't agree on style. Their architect's solution? Divide the house, classical in front, Gothic in back. The question, what is beautiful, became unanswerable, eventually replaced by engineers and modernists claiming function alone should determine form. Yet this separation between appearance and performance was illusory. We've always demanded buildings not only shelter us, but speak to us of whatever we find important. Abstract art reveals a crucial insight. Minimal cues trigger us to read objects as living figures. Barbara Hepworth's Two Segments and a Sphere, just marble shapes, somehow evokes a mother cradling her baby. Once attuned, living forms appear everywhere. Water jugs resemble penguins. Building facades have weary eyes. Even typefaces reveal personalities. Upright Helvetica suggests punctuality, while droopy Polyphilus appears sleepy. We judge buildings as we judge people. What we call beautiful in architecture mirrors the people we would love. Bayeux Cathedral's pointed arches convey ardor, while Urbino's Ducal Palace embodies serenity. Our ability to detect character in inanimate forms is astonishingly refined, yet we rarely discuss what buildings actually say to us. The world's great religions understood something we've forgotten. Where we are critically determines what we believe. Despite intellectual commitment to a creed, we remain devoted only when our surroundings affirm our values. We need gold panels, colored glass windows, and immaculately raked gravel gardens to stay true to our sincerest selves. Step from a harsh-lit London McDonald's into Westminster Cathedral's cavernous darkness, and everything shifts. What seemed absurd moments ago acquires profound significance, the architecture itself making concepts reasonable. Early Christian and Islamic theologians proposed something radical. Beautiful buildings could improve us morally and spiritually. A well-designed door handle could teach sobriety. A delicate window could deliver a sermon on gentleness. Secular architecture possesses the same power, offering the better parts of us a home. In 1575, Venice commissioned Paolo Veronese to paint the Doge's palace ceiling, a celebration of justice, peace, and moderation. Nearby, Palladio designed the Villa Rotonda with balanced facades embodying Renaissance ideals. Today, we find this idealizing style tedious and hypocritical, struggling with the gap between idealized architecture and messy reality. We reward art that reflects our condition rather than aspirations. Yet the idealizing tradition wasn't naive. Its proponents understood life rarely matched their visions. Their purpose was keeping before our eyes how life might optimally be, nudging us toward fulfillment. Friedrich Schiller believed idealized art could inspire us. Humanity has lost its dignity, but art has rescued it and preserved it in significant stone. We haven't abandoned idealization. We've merely shifted our values. Modern architecture still reflects selective images of who we might be, though beautiful things can sadden us by revealing how incomplete our lives remain. In a shabby London antique shop sits a once-beloved sideboard, now worthless due to changing tastes. Despite functional drawers and intact finish, its ornate Corinthian columns make it unsellable. Our aesthetic loyalties prove fickle, swinging between restraint and exuberance. Wilhelm Wöhringer's 1907 essay explains why. We're drawn to styles containing qualities we lack. Abstract art's symmetry appeals to chaotic societies yearning for calm. Realistic art attracts those in predictable environments seeking escape. The 17th century elite's taste for gilded walls reflected their violent, disease-ridden context. Modern preference for bare walls responds to our deficiencies. In our rule-bound, materially abundant world, we long for the natural and authentic. When Le Corbusier built modernist houses for factory workers in 1923, tenants quickly added pitched roofs, shutters, and flowered wallpaper, seeking what their working lives had stripped away. Understanding this mechanism helps us respond to aesthetic differences with insight rather than disbelief. We passively accept that new construction means desecration, neighborhoods less beautiful than the countryside they replace. Yet ugly developments aren't inevitable results of economics or politics, but stem from pedestrian combinations of low ambition, ignorance, and greed. Old maps reveal London's blighted suburbs were once orchards and meadows, ordinary grounds holding pure possibility. We mistakenly assume beauty is preordained for certain places or prohibitively expensive. Yet Bath's hills weren't inherently promising before transformation, nor Edinburgh's mosquito-infested fields. History shows how modest the means required for aesthetic revolutions can be. A few buildings and a single book have often sufficed. The Italian Renaissance was engineered by about 100 people. Our sadness at seeing bulldozers arrive stems not from opposing development, but from distaste for what replaces what's destroyed. We owe it to the fields our houses cover that our buildings embody the highest forms of happiness. Your next home, office, or city street isn't inevitable. It's a choice frozen in concrete and glass that will shape countless lives for generations. Choose beauty. Choose meaning. Choose spaces that remind us who we might become.